Hi everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department Podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their beginnings, their successes, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, I chat with literary agent and founder of Kowal Stanis Agency, Angerad Kowal Stanis. No one I know knows more about subsidiary rights than Angerad. If you don't know what subsidiary rights are, you will by the end of this episode. Among other topics, we talk about how she left her role at Writer's House as managing director in 2017 to start her own agency. She shares why, quote, nameless and faceless submission policies make no sense to her. And we discuss COVID-19's effect on publishing. I hope you enjoy our conversation. How are you holding up over there?
Fine. It's obviously a very stressful time for, you know, loads of people. But we're safe, we're healthy. So really, you know, in the bigger picture, we're fine. I think, you know, we're all worried about we're worried about so many things right now. But I think we're just taking it one day at a time and trying to work as much as possible and proceed as normally as possible.
Right. Well, speaking of working as much as possible, this is something I'll kind of want to touch on later in this conversation. But, you know, obviously we have COVID-19 affecting literally everything. There has been conversation about how it's affecting or what will it ultimately do to publishing, to this industry that we're in. So, you know, how are you seeing it so far, and where do you feel like it might be headed?
Okay, so that's a really good question, and I'm going to give you a kind of non-answer, which is that the honest answer is obviously I don't know. It depends on how long this goes on for and how intense the level of economic lockdown and retail lockdown is. You know, originally it was business as usual, and then we saw a surge in book buying, which was really nice, particularly in the classics. I don't know what it was like in the States, but there obviously everyone ran out to stock up on reading material, and lots of people I think were reminded of reading and buying books, and it was something they felt that was not only enjoyable during a time that's quite, you know, hard for so many people, but that that they could, it was something they could do, they could control. And so sales went up for a while. And obviously children's book sales in certain areas were quite strong for a little while. However, there's going to be fallout from this. I mean, right, I'm very lucky because none of my clients have books publishing exactly right now. And I think for those authors and illustrators, it's incredibly hard. Right. It's going to be a bit like September 11th was from a, you know, obviously when we're talking about publishing, which is that they just won't gain any traction, unfortunately. You know, what is the short term and the long term effect of this? I do not know, because I don't, I just don't know how soon we're going to be able to, you know, normalize to some extent.
Right.
So people are ordering books, but obviously there's going to, it's going to be a big hit.
Right.
And from a practical point of view, we're seeing a lot of books push back to 2021, 2022.
Yeah.
I think we'll definitely see the economics of this in the near future more and more.
Right. Yeah. I think that ultimately when things do normalize, I feel like the publishing industry, even though I have read that there have been furloughs and layoffs and things, will pick back up fairly quickly, kind of like the recession in 2007. It'll take about a year, I think, to pick back up. This is obviously a total guess. I don't know either. But this is my feeling. The book-buying public will still be there. In fact, I read recently that print sales has in the States is up a lot. People are ordering books. But the independent bookstores is where my concern lies
Yes.
The business owners are not going to. They are currently feeling the pain.
So as I said before, it's nice that this has, I think a lot of people that haven't, that are readers, but that haven't really read a lot lately or bought that many books lately because of life and all the other things that take up your time, have been reminded that one of their entertainment choices is reading, and it's brilliant. Yep. Okay. So there should be some upswing from that. Mm-hmm. And as you said, the producers are still, I mean, the publishers are still there. Mm-hmm. I think most of them will be fine in the long term. It's the retail sector. Right. And is that going to contract even more? Yep. And will some of the independent publishers, as you said, make it out of this?
Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about it in depth later in the episode. But before we get to that, you sound to me like you're from the Midwest. Where did you grow up? Because you're not from the UK, that's for sure.
So I was not born in Michigan, but I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Okay.
Yeah, from the age of 12, which is, you know, a literary town, if you can say that, where Borders was originally from. And I grew up there and went to university there.
Where'd you go to school?
University of Michigan.
Nice.
And then moved to New York City after.
What did you study at Michigan? Or University of Michigan?
English literature. So, yeah.
For what purpose? What were you planning on doing?
Oh, God, I had no purpose.
Did you say to yourself, you're 18 and you're like, I think I might be the director of rights one day?
No. I mean, does anyone know what sub-rights are before?
we will after this episode.
Yeah. So when I was growing up, publishing was very much an East Coast entity, possibly a little bit West Coast, but it really wasn't a profession that was ever kind of, I don't know, held in front of me, which is odd because I was a huge reader, huge, huge, huge reader growing up. But basically when I got to university, I was trying to do other things. And then ultimately, all I really wanted to do was read and talk about books. Mm-hmm.
So you graduated from University of Michigan. How did you go from there to Simon & Schuster? What year was that?
Okay. Oh, God. Okay. So I graduated in 1999.
Yep. Okay.
And
we're the same age then.
Yes, I think we are. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I wanted to go somewhere exciting and do something interesting. And I had no idea what that meant. But a very good friend of mine was moving to New York City, and she said, come with me. And I said, yes, this is my chance. Went to New York, worked managing the cafe for a few months at Borders Bookstore, mm-hmm. on Long Island. So,
were you living? Were you living in Long Island?
No, I was. This was the job that got me to New York.
Okay.
So, I needed to justify moving to New York City.
Yeah, of course.
So, I managed to get this job. Anyway, did that briefly, and then the commute was crazy. So, nice. Started looking for a job in the city, and you know, and was incredibly lucky to kind of get in touch with someone at Simon & Schuster, and it all just, and you know, they were hiring, they needed an assistant in the subsidiary rights department. I had no idea what that was. I went in for the interview. We really just talked about books for an hour.
Nice.
And they hired me.
Yep.
Lucky me.
That sounds very similar. I graduated in 99, and I graduated May of 99, June, I believe it was June 11th of 99. I could be wrong with the day. It was my first day at Simon & Schuster, June 99. When did you, what was your?
That's such a good, okay. So when did I start? So I graduated June 99. No, I didn't start until 2000.
Oh,
so
okay.
I spent a year finding my feet, like, you know, doing that other job, doing a bit of temping.
Okay.
And finding, and then, yeah. So I didn't start until the following year.
Right. And that sounds like my interview was, sort of similar to that. It was about an hour, and I spoke with Hani, my boss, then boss, about the Mets and the Orioles for an hour.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, that was it. And right at the end, she was like, oh, I guess I should look at your portfolio. Looked at it. I was like, I didn't get this job, but I got it.
That's so it's interesting that we're having this conversation because that's still how so much
of
what happens in publishing is
absolutely
accomplished.
Absolutely. I can't tell you, it's countless interviews I've given. I've interviewed designers for positions over the years, and it's not what I think people think. It's not where you sit down, you talk about the philosophy of art and design for an hour. It's a lot of times you're talking about where you're from and, what's your favorite pastime and that sort of thing. Because I think what people are gauging is, of course, you're in the interview. You're there because of what you've done and your credentials, your resume, your portfolio, whatever. So that's a given. I think what they really want to know is, like, is this person going to be good for the team? You know, are they going to be compatible? Do they fill a need? Will I want to see this person every single day? I think that was, for me anyway, part of the interview process.
I think that's very true. Someone we used to work with, who shall remain nameless, said once, I tossed the resume out the window, and I just think if I got stuck at an airport with them for several hours, would we get along? And I think that's how a lot of people hire and how a lot of business is done. Relationships to me drive at least half of everything that goes on in business.
In publishing especially. So subsidiary rights.
Yes.
I like to believe that I have a grasp on the concept of that, but I probably don't. So I have a lot of illustrators who listen to this. So let's, from their perspective, they've written a book, they're illustrating it, they sell it to a publisher. There are rights. And then there's subsidiary rights. Help me understand what the heck sub-rights are.
Okay, so the way that I describe it in layman's terms is that subsidiary rights or sub-rights are everything that you can do with a book other than publishing it in book form in the English language. So if you look at some of the major brands or books that have been turned into brands out there, like Winnie the Pooh or Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. It's all the other things that you see related to that book that aren't the original book. So that includes it being published, translated and published in German, in French, in Japanese, in Korean, in Spanish, and languages all over the world. That includes sub-rights, include audiobook editions, merchandise, so all the Harry Potter t-shirts and dress-up outfits and mugs. It includes calendars. It includes film and television rights, etc., etc. So it's quite a lot.
Theme parks,
yes, thank you. Yeah. I never think of that because it's quite unusual.
Yeah. Isn't there a provision in contracts that says something to the effect of, we have the right to do X with this art in formats known and unknown?
It depends on who is negotiating your contract. I think for an illustrator's purpose, the reason that this is important is because there's many different things that your artwork can be turned into in the long term, and many different sort of lives it can lead, and also many different ways to monetize that artwork. So one of the major reasons that I would advocate for most illustrators to have an agent is it's virtually impossible for them to know about this.
Yeah, publishers will send you a contract and they'll say, this is our standard contract, as if it's somehow
it's not benefiting you and not them. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's fine.
They do have a standard contract for unagented authors and illustrators. So it is their standard contract for that purpose, but it's not the contract that they would have, that an agented author or illustrator would have with the publisher.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you started off as an assistant, but right before you left SNS, you were the director of rights there, right?
Yeah, so I started off as an assistant, and I sort of grew up there from a professional point of view. I spent 10 years there.
Yeah, me too.
Or 9.5. And was, lucky enough to keep moving up and eventually became international rights director. So mm-hmm. my primary purpose was selling foreign language rights, mm-hmm. so books into other languages, which I adored, because it was basically seeing, it was basically meeting publishers from all over the world who are doing a lot of what you were doing, but just in another country and in another culture. So it was fascinating.
Yeah. How did you reach out to them? Was it, through book fairs, phone calls? I mean, what is the process as far as like selling? You have the rights to the book is published, let's say it's SNS. Now you're going to go out and sell the rights to foreign publishers. I mean, that's basically it, right?
Yes. So there are traditionally two major book fairs every year. The Frankfurt Book Fair in Germany in October is the biggest book fair in the world. And then there's also the Bologna Book Fair, which is in March or April in Italy and is exclusively children's. Mm-hmm. Now the London Book Fair, usually in April, is becoming bigger and bigger. So those are some of your, so these are people that you do business with all year long that you never see except for once or twice a year when we all get together in a foreign country. So that has historically been where, the brunt of the business was done. But of course, with technology, it's allowed us to do business with these people all the time. And it's still relationship based.
Right.
German publishers or Spanish language publishers, often buy books from the people that they know, whose tastes that they know, because they can't read. They can't read everything. It's impossible.
Right. I suspect that language isn't really a barrier. If it were, you may not have had a job. I don't know. Well, how do you navigate that?
You mean,
like, is that a dumb question? I mean,
does
everyone just speak English and that's that?
So, we're quite lucky because the language isn't a barrier for selling from the English language into another language. But obviously we don't import that many foreign language. We don't translate that much into the English language compared to how much they translate from English into foreign languages. There are sub-agents, which is a sub-agent is often you work in, let's say, Korea or Japan with someone who's bilingual, who's on the ground in Tokyo or Seoul.
Okay.
And you have relationships with them as well. And usually, I've been working with the same sub-agents my entire career. So I've known these people for 20 years, and those relationships are really longstanding. So they're bilingual, and they are also a part of the selling process into foreign languages.
Okay, what determines if a book, as director, right before you left SNS, how do I frame this question? What triggered your department to go out and sell sub rights for a particular title? Was it just simply good sales here, so you're figuring it'll sell well in other places? What's that determining factor?
That's a really interesting question. Most of our sales were done well before the book ever published in the States.
Really?
Yes. At least the sales process started well before, because of course, usually a book is acquired 24 months roughly before it's published, sometimes less, sometimes more. We would start really quite early because it often takes much longer in foreign language markets to place a book
But it's not every book though.
No. When I was at Simon & Schuster, my job was to represent every book to its best ability, but obviously certain books lend themselves better, children's fantasy lends itself incredibly well to being published in other languages because there's fewer cultural barriers, because it's fantastical.
Okay.
I don't know. From an illustration perspective, there are definitely aesthetic differences all over the world.
I'm so glad you mentioned that.
I mean, I could talk to you about that for a really long time. It's really fascinating.
It is fascinating. And I actually do want to talk to you about that.
Let's talk about it.
I recently spoke to an illustrator who's taking a course through the illustration department, who asked this very interesting question. You know, they have an agent, and I won't say who it is, and they reached out to me and said, Giuseppe, I'm having a tough time breaking into the American market. And I don't know why, and neither does my agent. She's in Europe. And I just, you know, looking at her portfolio, I actually don't know why either, because her work is amazing. There are certain tastes, I suppose, and certain taste makers, and I guess trends in each of these buying markets, each of these regions. But what is your experience? I mean, you left SNS, you went over to Writer's House, and you were there for a good, what, 7, 8 years?
Another 10 years.
Another 10 years. All right. So like,
do my career in 10.
Through 10 at SNS, through your 10 at Writer's House, you're obviously seeing all of this. So what is your take on that? What is your take on illustrators from different regions trying to break into other regions stylistically?
So
It's a big question.
No, I'm just trying to think how to break it down.
And is there anything to be done about it from an illustrator's perspective? I kind of feel like there isn't.
I don't think that they should think about it in a way as if they should do anything about it. I mean, you know, their artwork is their artwork. And I advocate for, commercial business reasons that you may have to do this or that when it comes to crafting your art, so that it can get published. But I wouldn't suggest that they should change kind of their styles that it works in another country, because I just think it's a really almost impossible task. I can particularly speak to the difference between the American and the British aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Because obviously I'm an American based in the UK, and I'm lucky enough to be able to, I think that one of my strengths is that I can, bridge that gap, and that I understand both cultures, but they are very different. I mean, the American style tends to be more painterly. Mm-hmm. They use it tends to have more line drawing in it, slightly more traditional or classic. Whereas most of what's being published in the UK tends to be more cartoon oriented. Okay. Cartoon's a dangerous word, but think Steve Antony, think Rob Bidoff, think a kind of really think core commercial, less painterly. When I say commercial, I mean it in a good way, but very accessible artwork to everywhere. Whereas, in a way, I almost feel like British publishers are trying to appeal directly to children aesthetically, contemporary children, more than whereas Americans are bridging that line between the children and the adult marketplace a bit more so. But America, so the American aesthetic just tends to be a bit more painterly, classic.
Okay. A little nostalgia ingredient in there.
Sometimes, I mean, Tony DiTerlizzi has his sort of Norman Rockwell inspiration and a bit of nostalgia in some of his characters and also his palettes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to answer your original question, I wouldn't suggest that they try and change their art style. I think that there will just be some illustrators who will work well in certain countries and won't work as well in others.
Right.
And that's part of, the beauty of publishing.
Right.
Is that, that you can't, that one size doesn't really fit all. Although with the internet and the world becoming more global, I think younger people are more interested aesthetically in what's going on in other countries because they're more exposed to it.
Oh yeah.
So some of those hard lines are blurring a little, which
absolutely.
Is nice.
Yep. Absolutely.
So there's more opportunity.
Right.
I mean, what's nice as an agent too is I think a lot of I like to think that I know what a little bit more what publishers are thinking because I've been one of them. if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
And so when there's a tendency for people to kind of gravitate towards the us, them, I hope that I'm able to explain a little bit more where certain things are coming from, mm-hmm. because I've been that person on the other side.
And then in 2017, you left Writer's House and went off on your own.
You know, I had always wanted to go out and do my own thing.
Right.
And I felt like professionally, if I was good, this was the time. When I was at Writer's House, I was looking after the entire client list in the UK and Australia. Mm. And I loved it. I mean, we had such an amazing list of clients that it was such a joy to work on, you know, everyone from, I mean, it just amazing, amazing people.
Like who? Like just give us like one or two.
God, you know, I worked on Stephen Hawking a bit. Mm-hmm. I worked a lot with Neil Gaiman. I worked with Nora Roberts, who is amazing. And the list just goes, I mean, I work with Stefan Pastis. I worked with everyone from picture book authors and illustrators, right, to middle grade writers, young adult. I mean, everything. Yeah. Karen Rose. I mean, I feel like I could name a few, but then it's so insulting not to name people. Do you know what I mean?
Just go on and on. Anyway.
And on, because they have such a great list. Yeah. But I had always started developing my own client list near the end.
Okay.
And really was struggling to find the time for it because there were 21 agents in the New York office who I was supporting. And also I was pulling from a UK pool, which aesthetically was quite different than the American sensibility. And I just really wanted to be part of the organic process from the beginning more. Yeah. And I just wanted, you know, I wanted to spend more time and energy on that. So, yeah. So I left and I set up the Coal Stannis agency. Yeah.
Yeah. I imagine it wasn't such a huge leap of faith, just based on your experience up until that point. Maybe it was like a little hop of faith to start your own agency and go off on your own.
I actually think probably the biggest leap in my career was leaving America and New York,
yeah,
and moving to another country on my own to set up the London office of Writer's House. I think that was probably the biggest jump, you know, when it comes to psychologically.
Right.
So no, it felt very natural to me.
So you launched, and when I was preparing for this episode, the thing that struck me maybe the most was that it was really easy to find your email address. I mean, it's like it's everywhere. And I bring that up because that's not always the case with other agents.
It wasn't conscious, but I think it's probably representative of how I run the agency. And one of the reasons I wanted to set up the Coal Stannis agency is that working in a smaller agency, I can give more of me.
Yeah.
If, you know, I can really interact with my clients and provide a level of service for them because I'm making all the decisions and there's no other demands on me that I don't feel like I've ever been able to give previously in my career. I feel like I wanted to make myself as accessible. I mean, when you set up your own agency, you're responsible for everything. So mm-hmm. From a good perspective and a bad perspective. And so and much of what you're selling to your clients is you, like what, you know, the service you can provide, what your experience is. Mm-hmm. Do they feel when they talk to you that they really think that you're going to make a huge difference in their career and that you can represent them well? Mm-hmm. So I did feel that I wanted people to be able to get a hold of me and that I didn't want it to be some sort of kind of submissions, you know, some nameless, faceless kind of agency with where you have no idea what's really going
exactly.
on.
Exactly. Yeah, there are some agencies, some medium to larger sized agencies where it's like, if you want to submit to us, email us at submission@theiragency.com. So you don't even know who's reading it. You don't know where it's going.
Or if anyone's reading it.
Or if any, exactly.
Yeah. No. And so I try to write back personally to everybody that sends me material. You know, it might take a little time, but it's me looking at it. It's me making the decision and it's me interacting with you.
Right. And this is a, so I have two thoughts on that. One is bless you for responding. I mean, it's just crazy. The stories I hear from illustrators about the amount of ghosting and radio silence that they receive. You know, they put their blood, sweat, and tears into a thing and then send it off into the world and get nothing. And that to me is just unacceptable. It's just unacceptable. I know it's standard practice especially in publishing and children's publishing with publishers and editors and art directors and agents. And I get that people are busy. I get it. But specifically with agents, it sucks. It's frustrating. It's very frustrating for illustrators to like hand their baby out to some stranger and then get nothing back. I mean, just something. Hey, I got it. So sorry. It's not part of, you know, it doesn't fit for my list. Here's one or two points why, you know, please, you know, good luck and blah, blah. That's it. And, you know, takes less time to draft a personal rejection letter back to these folks than it does to draft a tweet about your favorite TV show that you're binging. I mean, it's I can't tell you how frustrated I feel about this on a daily basis.
Was there a second? There was a second thing you wanted to say?
Yeah, it was. I forgot.
Or do you want me to respond to this?
No, first? There was. I forgot about what it was.
Okay. So, I wish that every single person who wrote to me, I could actually spend the time to give more feedback. But, you know, logistically, but at the bare minimum, I try to go back to everybody and at least give them a response. I think your words just really resonated with me. I think that so much of the agent client relationship is about mutual respect. Mm-hmm. And I think these people are giving you, you know, their dream and putting themselves out there and even though it doesn't make me any money to spend time telling people that it's, you know, the various reasons why I don't feel that I can sell their book or represent them from a human decency perspective, I think it's important to at least dignify the fact that they approached me and thought of me.
Exactly.
And dignify
their efforts. Just that's really, makes all the difference.
If they can spend the time to write to me, I can spend the time to write back to them.
Angerad, I'm glad to hear you say that, you know, especially with agents who, and not you, because again, your email is like right there. But you go through this rigmarole of, you know, do this and submit this and here's how you need to do it. And, you know, all of these little steps that you have to take to submit to somebody takes you 25 minutes to just send a damn email to somebody. And then nothing in return. It's just an unacceptable business practice, period.
Yeah, I don't really understand why so many people are so specific about how they want materials sent to them.
Oh my God. I know.
I mean, personally, like I quite like to get the whole manuscript or a large chunk of illustrations, but I certainly would, that's because if I'm enjoying something, I like to, you know, I don't want to stop. I want to be able to keep reading or looking at something. But I certainly wouldn't write somebody off because they didn't send it to me that way. And I don't know. Anyway,
I remember the second thing, by the way.
Oh, good. Okay, go ahead.
The second thing is for illustrators.
Yes.
And that is, if someone responds back to you with a, "I'm so sorry, it's not right for me," it can be frustrating and angering. It can be. And that is a perfectly acceptable and natural response. But please don't write back to them, especially when you're feeling angered, telling them to go to heck or, you know, some other thing. I think that's another reason why people don't respond so much, is because they're afraid that they're going to get back some kind of nasty reaction. So don't do that.
I mean, honestly, like, if I had to speak for most agents out there, I think that most of them would like to devote more time to saying, you know, the whys of why they did what. But I just think that it's really, I mean, it's probably a time management thing.
I know it is. Just then at the end of the email, say, "I would love to take a deeper dive into why, you know, into my decision here, but I'm so sorry, I just don't have the time. I wish you the best of luck." I mean, just clearly communicate. We're in the business of communicating, and it's blows my mind how poorly that connection is maintained.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's good that you raised this, because I think it's a very important thing for unagented illustrators and authors to think about what kind of relationship they want to have with their agent and what they want to get from their agent.
I read that when you look for author/illustrators or authors and illustrators and or illustrators or whatever, that you look for a good story and you look for like an emotional connection. Is that still true?
Yes. And I actually would say the emotional connection is number one for me, particularly with illustrators. Mm-hmm.
Is it one of those things where you just know when you know, you see it when you see it?
To some degree, yes. And that doesn't mean when I look at it, I know immediately that I want to represent them, or that I think, I don't know everything immediately, but I know immediately if there's an emotional connection with their work, because I feel that so much about buying or choosing books is about having some level of emotional connection, particularly when it's visual.
Right. We did touch on COVID-19, and if you were my agent, I had a conversation with another agent. I asked her the same question. If you were my agent, I would, I would call you and feel wary and ask, "Angerad, what should I be doing right now as an illustrator? What would you recommend?"
I think you should be doing everything the way that you were doing it before. Your question is, should they behave any differently because of COVID-19?
Yeah.
And its effects on the industry?
Yes. I guess what I'm asking my agent is for a little reassurance, you know?
Yes. I mean, I think that people need books more than ever right now. Mm-hmm. And I think reading novels, reading picture books has always been a form of escapism, a form of, you know, connecting to your emotions, a shared experience with your family or your loved ones. And I think all of those things are more important than ever right now. I think the disruption from COVID-19, from a publishing point of view, however, as awful as it is, and as detrimental as it will be to many people, will not last forever. And I think we need art and beauty and, you know, words more than ever. So I would say, keep going, put your head down, do your thing. You know, there is still a need for you in the world, and there is still a demand for you in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, as much as I'd love to keep talking and catch up with you, you have agent stuff to do, I'm sure, and kids stuff, and so do I. I was going to mention this earlier in the conversation, but I didn't want to derail anything, and I didn't want to make you feel self-conscious. But I hear a smidge of a British accent.
Do you?
A little bit. Like the smidgiest smidge. A little bit.
Inflection.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yes.
It's in the O's.
Probably. My T is a little bit differently now too sometimes.
It's like...
It was probably inevitable.
Oh, yeah. The reason I hear it too is because I'm from Maryland, and the Marylanders, the sort of mid-Atlantic accent, it has a long O. So like phone, home, the Orioles,
oh, right.
You know, down the coast. Like, and I heard that a little bit in what some of the stuff you were saying, especially with your O's. So,
yes. Well, you know,
there you go.
I definitely have picked that up.
Okay.
The inability to say a straightforward sentence from time to time.
Nice.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I love living in the UK, and but I still love the American market. And I love being able to see things through the lens of a slightly foreign perspective, although now it's home. So I don't know. I love having an international base.
Right.
Because that's my experience in publishing, but also because that's the world now.
Yeah. If I were to design my like ideal agent, it would be somebody who worked in publishing, who understands the UK and the US market, someone who fully understands not just publishing rights, but all subsidiary rights, and somebody who's running their own smaller boutique agency. Like that would be, those boxes would be checked for me for my ideal agent. And that's you.
Thank you so much. That's really kind of you to say.
I might have sent a few illustrators your direction, by the way. And I'm going to continue to do that.
That's the other thing I'd like to say is, you know, I am always looking for new clients and talent all the time. Like I want to see as much as people want to send me. I don't really understand these people who say, I'm going to sort of look at somebody new. I'm open for submissions for 2 weeks. I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes.
I feel like if I love something, who doesn't always want to see another amazing piece of artwork?
Who could you be missing out on by doing that, by closing your window?
I just feel like that's such an odd way of handling. I think it's an antiquated approach to business within publishing, whereby literary agents asserted certain levels of control. But that's just not my style.
Yeah, there you go. I know people listening in all this going like, ask her how she looks for illustrators. Ask her, how do you, really quickly.
How do I find my clients?
Yeah.
Top secret. And I've got, actually, it is top secret. So that's the number one question that I get asked.
I know.
And, you know, I find my clients many, many different ways. There isn't just one. I find my clients through social media. I find a lot of my clients come through people writing to me directly through my website or through my email address.
Okay.
So... what was traditionally a slush pile, like that's, you know, that's how I found a lot of my clients. Mm-hmm. And bless the internet for making all of that possible. Right. So I really encourage people to write to me directly and just tell me about their work.
Mm-hmm. Simple as that. So let's remember that we do have some folks listening in on this conversation. What would be your last bit of advice for them?
Gosh, I think my best bit of professional advice that I don't feel gets talked about enough is that when you are thinking about illustrating for books, you really need to think about that your illustrations will actually be turned into books. Let me describe that a little bit more. I get beautiful pieces of artwork all the time, or I see illustrators that I love. I love their work. Like, I would love to buy a piece of original artwork and put it in my house. I think they're incredibly talented, but it's the illustrators that are able to think a little bit commercially about how they can turn their artwork or utilize their artistic skills into pieces of art that will work, that will tell a story, that are accessible for whatever genre they're, you know, illustrating for. Those are the ones that will make their lives a lot easier and their careers better.
To learn more about Angrad, visit koalstanisagency.com. If you enjoyed our conversation, please share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, and provide a positive rating and review. Become a patron by visiting patreon.com/illustrationdept. In return, you'll receive a gift, a discount code, and access to short episodes we're calling Extra Credit. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit us at illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, the podcast show notes, our new forum, the bookshop, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.